Family relationships are vital to our lives. We know that. And really vital to our culture. There's no doubt that they go a long way towards shaping who we are as people, both good and bad. And from the perspective of our Christian faith, the Bible has a great deal to say about these relationships, so it's important that we gain insight from its teaching and not simply just adopt our understanding from the wider culture, because the two things aren't always in sync. And let me say, without equivocation, that I believe that the biblical record on these relationships is the best wisdom that we have at our disposal. I want to be clear that I'm not saying modern psychology and other social sciences don't have something to contribute to the conversation. Of course they do. And in many cases, those two things can be easily harmonized. But as Christians, we give Jesus the first and the last word. And that's what we're trying to communicate, I guess, in an artistic way through our series Graphic. You know, while it's true that the modern world is extremely different from the biblical one, Jesus and his word still provides us the teaching that undergirds our understanding of family relationships today. And many today in the secular arena, because of their real lack of understanding of what the Bible is really teaching, they view the biblical wisdom as outdated and in some cases even outrageous. But rather than criticize, I think that in humility we should ask ourselves some questions. And Bishop N.T. Wright poses this to us. He says, do our modern societies in which marriage and family life is often a tragedy or a joke really offer a better model of how to do it? Does the specter of broken homes littering modern Western culture indicate that we've got it right and can tell the rest of human history how we finally resolved the battle of the sexes? Or does it indicate that we still need to do some rethinking somewhere? And so to begin our series, we're going to focus on the big picture, the purpose of marriage. And this is described by the Apostle Paul in his letter to the church in Ephesus. And the reason that we're going to start here is very simple. If we want to gain an understanding of marriage and family relationships from a Christian point of view, then it begins with understanding the purpose or goal. The biblical word used here is the word telos, meaning the ultimate object or aim, the end of a goal-oriented process. We all just intuitively understand that if we incorrectly conceive of something's purpose, then we will not reach or fulfill the ultimate goal or aim, no matter how hard we may be working. You know, no matter how sincerely we are trying. I have a nephew, Ford. There he is. There he is, yeah. And that's his dad. He's playing the drums at the other end today, and we'll be down here at 10:45. But Ford played soccer for the first time this season. And he's a young guy, as were all the participants. And one thing you need to know about Ford is, I describe Ford as a cool cat. Ford, he walks to the beat of his own drum, so to speak. He's always doing his thing and not what everyone else is doing. And one way that we see this is that Ford loves money. He loves money. Now, I don't mean greed. I mean, he actually loves the bills and the coins. He loves money. He loves to play with money. And all the cousins will be out playing in the yard and running around or whatever, and Ford is sitting in the kitchen and lining up all of his money on the floor. Well, early in his first soccer game, Ford spotted a dollar bill on the ground. I don't know how this happened, but he just was in heaven. You know, he finds this dollar bill, and he hurries and picks it up, and then he starts proudly displaying it to Michael and Aaron, his parents, and he is completely unaware of what is going on in the soccer game. And now, because he has found this dollar bill, he thinks there's more. So he spends the rest of the game like this, you know, looking around for money on the ground, and is completely oblivious to the fact that there's a soccer game going on. Now, he was very sincere in his search for more money, and he was working very diligently at it. But no matter how much effort you put forth, searching for money on the ground during a soccer game is missing the mark. I mean, you know, that's not the point. And, you know, Ford's a little kid, and that's cute, and it doesn't mean anything. But unfortunately, when it comes to marriage, many adults, many Christians are like that. They're looking for money on the ground, unaware that the point of the game is to put the ball in the net. And this confusion about the purpose of marriage, it has really damaging effects. So before we dig into the purpose of marriage as it's explained by the Apostle Paul, let's begin with the money on the ground idea. The tangent that most people are pursuing in marriage. Because I don't think we'll ever really embrace the positive biblical idea for marriage unless we simultaneously become aware of and repent of our faulty conceptions. So for this, we're going to go back to the 18th and 19th centuries. And we're going to take a look at what we call the Enlightenment or the Age of Reason. This was a period of time in history that flowed out of the Renaissance and Reformation, where there was an explosion of scientific discovery and a seriously increased value placed on human freedom and autonomy. Now, before the Enlightenment, meaning in life was defined by identification with and the common good of a group, a clan, a family, a tribe, or a nation. In other words, if we were to go back to 1100 AD, before the Enlightenment, my life had meaning because I was a wildman. And Stephen Adlington, my British coach, told me how to pronounce this. It's not Berkshire, it's Berkshire. Is that right, Jeannie? Berkshire, yes. I was a wildman of Berkshire, lord of the manor of Bocot, servant of Henry, the King of England, who was the son of William the Conqueror. That was my purpose in life, was to fulfill that role. And marriage, in that context, was an institution that was designed to serve that common good by helping people, by helping me fulfill my assigned role. That role was assigned to me by God. And that was my sole purpose in life. But during the Enlightenment, all that began to change. July 4th, 1776, that should ring a bell. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. That's an Enlightenment idea. That they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, that's a sentence that changed the world. And hopefully, you can see a shift in the thinking there between the way it was before the Enlightenment, the increased value in human freedom and dignity and happiness. And the Enlightenment became understood that people have value as individuals, not simply as fulfilling some sort of pre-assigned role in society. And that thinking, Enlightenment thinking, really changed the way that we began to think about marriage. I want to quote Tim Keller and his book, The Meaning of Marriage. This is a fantastic book. It's on sale in the bookstore, so I encourage you to get a copy of this. And it's a pretty easy read. You could read it during this sermon series. I think you would really be blessed by doing that. Anyway, he says this: the meaning of life came to be seen as the fruit of freedom to choose the life that most fulfills him or her personally. And he's talking about the meaning of life coming out of the Enlightenment. And marriage was seen as a contract between two parties for mutual individual growth and satisfaction. Persons married for themselves, not to fulfill responsibilities to God or society. In short, the Enlightenment privatized marriage, taking it out of the public sphere and redefined its purpose as individual gratification, not any broader good. Now, I want to encourage you here. Tim Keller is not saying the Enlightenment was bad, okay? He's simply talking about what is some of the outcomes, you know, down the road from this. So in all of this, I want to encourage you to refrain from the black and white, either-or kind of thinking. Both, you know, pre-Enlightenment and Enlightenment were mixed bags. They had good things and bad things. And to be sure, there were and are long-term, unforeseen, and unintended consequences to the Enlightenment. The original proponents of the Enlightenment, like the signers of our Declaration of Independence, I don't think that they could have imagined the hyper-individualism that we now have today. I'm confident that if they were here with us today and they would see this hyper-individualism that we practice today, I think they would say, whoa, 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 wait a minute, that's not what we meant. But their ideas did give birth to it over time. It's been the frog in the kettle phenomenon, you know, so to speak. Regardless, here we are. And the truth is, and I know this because I talk to couples, the truth is most couples entering marriage carry the assumption, either consciously or not, that the purpose of the marriage is to make them happy. That's what people think. I mean, why? I mean, because this is just the air we breathe. Why would you get married if it's not going to make you happy? Because that's what we're all about, the pursuit of happiness. Here's a New York Times columnist, Tara Parker Pope, and I quote from her article entitled, "The Happy Marriage is the Me Marriage." And I promise you, I didn't make it up. You can look it up, New York Times. "The Happy Marriage is the Me Marriage." The notion that the best marriages are those that bring satisfaction to the individual may seem counterintuitive. After all, isn't marriage supposed to be about putting the relationship first? Not anymore. For centuries, marriage was viewed as an economic and social institution, and the emotional and intellectual needs of the spouses were secondary to the survival of the marriage itself. But in modern relationships, people are looking for a partnership, and they want partners who make their lives more interesting. However, there's a huge problem with this idea, and Pope mentions this problem in her article, but she doesn't even know that it's a problem. She doesn't even know that she's undermining her own argument. Here's what she quotes, a doctor, Dr. Gary Lewandowski, professor at Monmouth University, and here's his quote: "If you're seeking self-growth and obtain it from your partner, then that puts your partner in a pretty important position." And I want to say, pretty important? Like, yeah, pretty important. We could translate that as impossible. Or how about soul-crushing? Or how about a burden the size of Mount Everest that you have just put on your partner? I mean, do you see the train wreck that's coming here? Two people come together in marriage, and the purpose isn't us or even something higher. Rather, the purpose is me and me. I mean, imagine this conversation. Now, let's get this straight before we marry. This marriage is about me. Well, you've got the me part right, but it's not me meaning you. It's me meaning me. I mean, that argument is clearly absurd, but unfortunately, that argument is being played out in millions of marriages. And it really shouldn't be surprising to us that this creates all kinds of unrealistic expectations that we place upon our marriage partners, and that has led to a decline in marital satisfaction, and it has led to an increased level of pessimism about the institution of marriage itself. I mean, this makes sense. If the point of marriage is that the other person is going to make me happy, then we're likely to become very dissatisfied, because the truth is, no person can do that. No person can make you happy. And so if they fail to make you happy, then you're dissatisfied. Here's what Keller says. A marriage based on self-fulfillment will require a low or no maintenance partner, there is no such thing, I'm as high maintenance as they come, who meets your needs while making almost no claims on you. Simply put, today people are asking far too much in a marriage partner. And so we think about it, therefore marriages fail because they're not working. And what does that mean? It means it's not making me happy. And so therefore, because it's not working, because I'm not happy, I'm now growing kind of pessimistic about this whole thing we call marriage because, well, it doesn't work. Makes us jaded. And we have a whole culture filled with younger people who do not even believe that a good marriage is even possible. This is true. The data is overwhelming, and it's frightening. They are rejecting marriage as an institution because they don't believe it works. And it doesn't work because it doesn't guarantee your happiness. Well, does Jesus have anything to say? Well, indeed he does. Jesus taught extensively about how to have healthy relationships and about marriage. Marriage is a relationship after all. And he taught specifically about marriage. He even had his coming out party, as we heard, at a wedding in Cana of Galilee. The Bible has quite a few passages about marriage, Old and New Testaments, and Paul wrote at length about the subject. We read about that in Ephesians chapter 5. The Book of Common Prayer, the marriage ceremony, it opens in the opening statement is a summary of the biblical teaching on marriage, and it helps us to get at this question: what is the purpose of marriage from a Christian point of view? It begins like this. Dearly beloved, we have come together in the presence of God to witness and bless the joining together of this man and this woman in holy matrimony. The bond and covenant of marriage was established by God in creation, and our Lord Jesus Christ adorned this manner of life by his presence and first miracle at a wedding in Cana of Galilee. It signifies to us the mystery of the union between Christ and his church, and Holy Scripture commends it to be honored among all people. Now, that didn't say anything about our happiness. That last sentence, that's what we're looking for. What is the purpose of marriage from a Christian perspective? It signifies to us the mystery of the union between Christ and His church. Huh? What's he talking about? It's a reference. This is a reference to what Paul wrote in Ephesians chapter 5. So after Paul has at length explained how husbands and wives are to treat each other, he then writes, "This is a great mystery, and I am applying it to Christ and the church. Each of you, however, should love his wife as himself, and a wife should respect her husband." What does he mean? What is he talking about? Let's try a different translation that maybe help us get at the meaning of this. Let's try the New Living Translation. "This is a great mystery, but it is an illustration of the way Christ and the church are one. So again, I say, each man must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband." Is the meaning getting a little clearer? Let's try Eugene Peterson's "The Message." "This is a huge mystery, and I don't pretend to understand it all. What is clearest to me is the way Christ treats the church. And this provides a good picture of how each husband is to treat his wife, loving himself and loving her, and how each wife is to honor her husband." Back to our question. What is the purpose of marriage from a Christian perspective? Well, it isn't about me. It isn't about you or even us. From a Christian perspective, marriage is about God. The goal or the telos of marriage is to signify, to be a sign of the love that Christ shares with his people, the church. In other words, husbands and wives are to love each other in such a way that they image God's love in the world. That is the purpose of marriage. Again, let's read from the meaning of marriage. "Jesus' sacrificial service to us has brought us into deep union with him and he with us. And that," Paul says, "is the key not only to understanding marriage, but to living it." As one commentator put it, Paul saw that when God designed the original marriage, he already had Christ and the church in mind. This is one of God's great purposes in marriage, to picture the relationship between Christ and his redeemed people forever. That is the great mystery that Paul is talking about. And to be sure, there are not many people who are tying the knot with that understanding. It's not about our happiness. Although a marriage that fulfills its God-given purpose will no doubt be filled with many moments of happiness, and also many moments of sadness and despair. I mean, come on. We've lived enough life. We know this. And we need to teach our kids and our grandkids this. Because if you think this is going to make you happy, you are set up for failure. It's not even about the common good. Although a marriage that fulfills its God-given person will certainly greatly enhance the common good. Ultimately, marriage is about God by imaging his love into this broken and hurting world. And in this way, Christian marriages where husbands and wives love each other with the love of God, that marriage then becomes a picture of the gospel. It becomes a picture of the good news of Jesus. Couples that I marry, I at least know that they've heard this because I tell them. I want them to aspire to and to experience everything that God has for them. And to do that, they need to know what marriage is all about. Loving each other as Christ loves the church. Next week, we're going to talk about how that is possible. It is a lofty goal. And how can we live it out? We're going to talk about how to make marriage work.